Chapter 13. Some Things That You Have Missed Before. Sandrine. Darkness was falling on Budapest on a brisk evening in the third week of April, when Szabolcs Csányi walked through the gaudy lobby of a downtown hotel on his way to a meeting with a pair of his heroes. The renowned investigative reporters, Bastian Obermeier and Frederick Obermeier, had just arrived in town from their home base in Munich for a secret conference with Szabolcs and his editor at Direct 36, András Pétu. The Süddeutsche Zeitung journalists were waiting upstairs in a rented room with a computer full of fastidiously secured and encrypted data, ready to read Szabolcs and András into the Pegasus Project. The hotel itself was a little deflating, Szabolcs remembers. A disgusting interior, like a cheap ripoff of a Trump hotel, with lots of fake golden decoration and everything, he says. I was really nervous, and excited at the same time that finally will be revealed some big secret. There were a few maddening hoops for Szabolcs and András to jump through even after they arrived at the appointed room. The two journalists first had to power down their cell phones and other devices and store them in another room, where the electronics would remain throughout the meeting. They also had to take a rapid test to screen for possible COVID infection, and then cool their heels inside the bathroom until the results came in. So Szabolcs and András waited out the last 15 minutes, still in the dark as to the details of the Pegasus Project and their place in it. These were the final frustrating moments of an already long and disquieting wait for Szabolcs Csányi. A month had passed since I had first told Szabolcs, by remote hookup, that the security lab's forensic analysis found evidence that his iPhone had been successfully infected with spyware. I had not been able to give him many details at the time. No mention of NSO or Pegasus. I still remember Szabolcs' immediate reaction. His first instinct had been to reach out to warn his sources. Szabolcs had hundreds of sources, many of them inside Hungary's intelligence, political, and business communities. And his work had touched a lot of sensitive nerves in and around Budapest the previous few years. Just days before we alerted him of the spyware infection, Szabolcs had dropped a 9,000-word story detailing the growth of the Hungarian government's diplomatic and financial entanglements with China over the course of Prime Minister Viktor Orbán's 11-year run in office. Szabolcs's report in Direct 36 headlined, "How Orbán's Eastern Opening Brought Chinese Spy Games to Hungary," represented months of investigation with reams of documents and data to back it, and some 60 interviews with official and unofficial sources, most of them unnamed for their protection. The report had embarrassed Orbán's ruling Fidesz party. The takeaway of the story was that China had gamed Orbán and Fidesz with unkept promises of major financing and favorable loans to Hungary's cash-strapped government. Little had come of Orbán's China-friendly Eastern opening policy, besides an opening for China to fill Hungary with thousands of proselytizers and citizen spies, and to get a foothold in the EU for profit-seeking. "They do everything for money," an unnamed Hungarian diplomat formerly stationed in Beijing explained to Szabolcs. Szabolcs analyzed the one big Hungary-China collaboration of the past decade, a 1.9 billion euro reconstruction of a railway line between Belgrade and Budapest, and found it to be a sinkhole of cash with a puny return for Hungarians. A Chinese-Hungarian consortium won the construction contract, with two Chinese state railway builders joining forces with a company of Lőrinc Mészáros, Viktor Orbán's childhood friend and Hungary's richest businessman, Szabolcs wrote. As a former senior foreign ministry official put it, this also shows that the Eastern Opening eventually turned out to be just a ninja smokescreen designed to conceal Hungarian graft and corruption. Hungary's national economy hardly benefited from the pro-China turn in foreign policy. Only business circles close to the government profited from it. The day we informed him of the spyware attacks on his iPhone, Sabolcs was finishing up the reporting on a follow-up story detailing a more recent Eastern opening boondoggle. Also, as he would write, based on the model of the Budapest-Belgrade railway investment, he hoped to publish in early April. The 35-year-old investigative reporter was aware these stories would likely have uncomfortable personal consequences, but he had grown accustomed to being the target of angry recrimination from key players in Fidesz. The Prime Minister's chief international spokesman had already identified Sabolcs as an enemy of the state, publicly accusing him of Orbanophobia and Hungarophobia. Fidesz apologists in the media occasionally spewed the lie that Sabolcs was a foreign spy, likely CIA. Sabolcs Panyi had operated his entire journalistic career inside the tightening noose of Orbán's soft authoritarian rule. The Prime Minister had showed himself a sly tactician since taking office in 2010. He had used electoral reforms to deliver Fidesz a supermajority in the Hungarian parliament, and then used those friendly lawmakers to rewrite the constitution. The bloodless legislative coup sabotaged democratic institutions, undermined the rule of law, and accrued power to Orbán himself. He has disguised his dismemberment of democracy through a package of laws written in impenetrable legalese that only a handful of experts can hope to decipher, says one observer. The Prime Minister and his Fidesz minions were also working to suppress media critical of the government. Reporters who tried to get at the truth of the ruling party's corruption and malfeasance didn't routinely get jailed or physically harmed or smeared with salacious criminal charges like they did in Morocco, but they were watched. These things have been going on for 4 years now, Sabolcs told us in 2021. There was one occasion when I was meeting a source, but in another town. And when I was going to meet him, there was physical surveillance on me, meaning these, you know, classic short-haired muscular guys in brown leather jackets, just standing there and then walking behind me. And after my meeting with this source, when I was traveling back to Budapest on a train, I was sitting in an empty train cabin, and a similar guy just arrived. And he was standing there throughout the whole train ride, more than an hour, just standing there in the cabin door, not moving. He didn't have any luggage. This is, as we call it, demonstrative surveillance. They want you to know that they are following you. It's slightly threatening, but it's more about sending a signal that we're watching you. We know what you're doing. We know who you're meeting. And this physical surveillance did have an effect on the story that I was working on, because I couldn't use the information that I obtained, because obviously the meeting was compromised, and I didn't want that source to get into trouble. Sabolcs never considered himself technically proficient, but he had always been careful. He used the latest iPhone because of Apple's reputation for security, and he steered clear of any electronic devices manufactured in China, which almost certainly had backdoors in their operating software. He used encrypted messaging services like Signal and Wickr. He used VPNs. When an operative in Hungarian intelligence warned Sabolcs that a competing agency might be using digital means to spy on him, it just didn't seem cause for panic. Sabolcs had never found Orbán's security services particularly competent or energetic. But when I informed him that somebody was using his own iPhone to surreptitiously spy on him, that he was carrying around their weapon for them, it felt like a quantum leap in capability and intent. It had shaken him. Unlike the demonstrative surveillance, this had been done in stealth, with no signal and no way to know just what the security services were after or what they had learned. I was really afraid that my sources could be jeopardized and they could get into trouble, he says. So that's why I was really freaking out. Sabolcs felt obliged to tell some of the sources he used in his China reporting that their communications might have been intercepted, But his editor at Direct 36 cautioned against it.
Come on, don't do that, András counseled. We don't have enough information right now. And this story, I mean, the cyber surveillance story, is just too sensitive.
Claudio had managed to talk him down a bit also. The cyber surveillance had happened over a specific period of time, from April to December 2019, Claudio had assured him. There was no evidence of recent infection, or, as Sabolcs called it, infestation. So Sabolcs kept the unsettling information to himself, took all the extra security precautions Claudio recommended, and convinced the security lab to do a new forensic analysis on his phone every few weeks just to be sure. Finally, a month later, in that splashy, gilded hotel in Budapest, Sabolcs was about to get the lowdown on what exactly had happened inside his iPhone, and how it connected to a much larger story of cyber surveillance. Again, sorry to not be able to reveal everything, because most of it will be revealed, the whole extent of our project, in our meeting in Paris in May. Frederick Obermeier said to Sabolcs and András by way of introduction. So we would focus on what we know so far from Hungary. We know that several hundred numbers from Hungary were targeted. We have reason to believe they were targeted by a state actor from Hungary. Part of Direct 36's role, Frederick and Bastian explained, would be to help identify people in our data who might be willing to let us run forensics on their cell phones. Hungarians who could also be trusted to keep mum while we completed the investigation. Frederick and Bastian ran through a few of the selected Hungarian targets already identified by name. One of Orbán's key ministers, now retired, for instance. He's not even an outspoken critic, András noted. And a member of one of the most important opposition parties in Hungary.
Are you going to tell him? András asked of the opposition politician.
We would rather try to first speak with him, Frederick said. If we have a super good feeling, and if you also agreed that one can kind of trust him, but we would first of all leave the decision to you.
I'm skeptical, Bastian said, worried the former minister might not be willing to remain silent until our story broke, because he is very outspoken.
I don't know him well, András said. I spoke with him only a couple of times. But here's the danger. He likes talking. And when you talk to him, he tells you everything.
Okay, Frederick added. So that's a no-go.
That's when Frederick opened up his laptop and unveiled to Sabolcs and András the real gem in our possession. He took out an unassuming-looking memory stick, plugged it into a USB port, and accessed our list with the protocols Claudio and Danica had tailored for the Pegasus project. The file was encrypted, and Frederick typed in the three long and complicated passwords. Voila, there it was, finally, for Sabolcs and András to see. Hundreds of selected cell phone numbers categorized under the heading of Hungary. Some identified by name, and some not. Frederick and Bastian were going to send backups of Sabolcs' and András's separate contact files to the security lab in Berlin later that night to see if Claudio and Danica could match other names to the still unidentified Hungarian cell numbers on the list. Frederick scrolled down through the list as Sabolcs and András looked for names they recognized.
Oh, she's a former ambassador to China. And now she's an advisor to Orbán, foreign policy advisor. Sabolcs said, pointing out one familiar name. I have her number.
Ooh, okay, András said. He's in finance, investment banker.
I think it's really interesting to see how many people are not there for criminal reasons, but for purely political reasons, Bastian told them.
For me, from Germany, that's a big scandal.
This will be one in Hungary, I bet, Sabolcs added.
Sabolcs found himself experiencing a déjà vu moment, reliving the strange sensations that had washed over him
when he had first learned he'd been targeted by cyber surveillance weapons. I was very excited that I was presented with this database, and there was this possibility to work from it, but it was also really unnerving, he said later. I remember especially the name of this guy who worked in Viktor Orbán's own government. He's a retired, old, very respected, very kind economist, respected throughout the political spectrum. And to see his name among the victims of surveillance, that was the biggest shock because there's basically no wrongdoing that he could have been involved in. And then seeing the names of very shady people in the same list, Hungarian mobsters who were occupying all the police bulletins and on the evening news back in the 90s, mobsters involved in organized crime and violence, some Arabic characters there, and Russian names, which, you know, we suspect of being legitimate targets of either counterintelligence or counterterrorism investigations. And then finally seeing my name among terrorism suspects or suspected drug dealers? That's shocking. That there's someone operating the system to whom it just doesn't matter if they surveil a serious criminal or young investigative journalists like myself. Before they broke up the meeting for the night, Frederick and Bastian presented Sabolcs with much more detailed information from the forensic analysis Claudio and Danica had completed on his phone. They basically created a timeline of what they saw on your phone, Frederick explained. The timestamps of the cyber attacks in 2019 were identified down to the day, the hour, the minute. Sabolcs had his calendar out matching the timeline. He remembered he had been investigating the growing Trump-Orbán relationship, which involved a lot of talk of weapon sales. That day, I was meeting with an arms dealer, he said, pointing to one of the lines in the chronology from the security lab. That one? Frederick asked. In Hungary? Yes, that story had a U.S. angle and a Russian angle. And Hungarian? Said Frederick. Hungarian as well. Sabolcs explained, and also some Israeli angle. The guy I was meeting noticed that there was also someone sitting next to us from a certain embassy, who was known to work for the intelligence agency of that foreign country. Oh, wow, Frederick said. And Bastian pressed Sabolcs. Can you tell us? It was the United States. Sabolcs wanted some clarity on one last thing concerning forensics. Claudia had told him that whoever had infected his iPhone had only exfiltrated between 50 and 100 megabytes of data. I assume those were not pictures or videos, but rather texts, Sabolcs said. But neither Frederick nor Bastian could say for sure. We have to fear for the worst, Frederick explained. My assumption is chat logs, Sabolcs said. Almost pleading now. The assumption is that everything that you saw on your cell phone was accessed and everything that you spoke and wrote, Frederick said. Even a signal message that is, in theory, encrypted could be read using this technology. Because when you are typing it, then basically it would be intercepted there. So it would not be intercepted on the way when it's already encrypted, but while you type it in. But it cannot access the encrypted messages I am receiving and reading, Sabolcs asked. Just what I'm typing. They can basically access everything that you see, Frederick told him. If you're receiving a signal message that was encrypted on the way, as soon as you read it and you can see it here on your phone, then they can access it. Okay, Sabolcs said. Smiling through obvious pain. This is the huge danger, Frederick told him. Because we all as journalists were feeling kind of secure, even after the whole Snowden NSA revelations, that as soon as we use technology like Signal, that our communications were kind of secure. This is a huge threat for all of us and our sources. When Frederick and Bastian showed up at the Detect 36 office for a second meeting the next day, Claudio and Danica had already matched more than a dozen numbers from Sabolcs' contact list with numbers in our data. Sabolcs took one of the matching numbers and typed it into his phone. Well, he sighed, that seems to be our colleague working here.
At the paper? Bastian asked.
We don't have a name for this number.
Sebulch identified the number as belonging to Andrash Szabo, who was at work in the next room.
So, a second colleague from Direct 36, Bastian said.
That's annoying.
Sebulch called Andrash Szabo into the conference room to get his permission for the forensics. Then the team uploaded a backup of Andrash's iPhone to the security lab, and the preliminary results came back an hour or so later. Frederick presented the findings to Sebulch, Andrash Petu, and Andrash Szabo. This represented fully half of the Direct 36 editorial staff. It looks like he was compromised on June 13, 2019, and again on September 24th, same year, 2019, Frederick told them.
Me? Andrash Szabo said, looking stunned.
Yes, you.
Wow.
I think it would be good to go through your calendar and your memories, basically, Frederick suggested.
I have a problem, Andrash Szabo explained. Last year, the Hungarian police invited me as a witness in a case, and before these police came to pick me up, I deleted a lot of stuff from my calendar.
Sebulch was already scanning the Direct 36 archives to identify the stories his colleague had published back in the relevant months of 2019. Just before the initial cyber attack, Andrash had published an investigation into Orbán's Minister of Communications. The Fidesz official and his wife had both been gifted luxury cars by a company with ties to Russia. Then he did a story on an opposition poll suspected of financial fraud. Then one on the construction contract for a Hungarian nuclear power plant project that had been given to the Russian corporation, Rosatom. Andrash explained he had important anonymous sources on the nuclear plant story.
So it could be somebody trying to find out who your sources are, Frederick posited.
Or maybe your sources tipped the government.
Maybe, Andrash said. He didn't know what to think. But a few things were clear to the Direct 36 team. This was going to be a big story, and there was a lot of work to be done.
I think it would be good if you could go through your notes again and think about which sources could be in danger, Frederick suggested.
Just those 2 days? Andrash asked.
As far as we understand the system now, those were the days the infections took place, Frederick told them. But that doesn't mean it's only those days. It could be that someone was listening and reading afterward.
Andrash Petu, ever the editor, reminded Sebulch and Andrash Szabo that they needed to keep all this information between the three of them. For now, he said, it was best if they told none of their co-workers.
Don't even put it in your computer that this meeting took place, Frederick cautioned. Don't speak to anyone about it.
The confirmation of infection on Andrash Szabo's iPhone marked the end of a very productive month at the security lab in Berlin, including the recent confirmation of an iPhone belonging to a reporter in Mexico. Claudia and Danica had found traces of Pegasus left behind on 10 different cell phones in that brief time, across at least 4 separate countries. The success rate was, in Claudio's experience, off the charts. Even the handful of iPhones that came back clean had been useful in helping Amnesty International's 2-man cybersecurity team catalog the millions of legitimate process names in iOS or in apps installed from the Apple Store.
There's no documentation for any of it, Claudio told us. It's not like Apple publishes the details.
So there's been a process of understanding and getting more familiar with the iPhone operating system as well. The sudden rush of forensic analyses had swelled the security lab's list of legitimate iOS process names, but it had also swelled the list of illegitimate Pegasus-generated process names. Glaringly apparent was the fact that somebody at NSO was cleverly naming the malicious Pegasus processes to help camouflage the attacks. Adding or subtracting or moving a letter here, changing a digit there.
Apple's legitimate CK key role D, for instance, became NSO's malicious CK key role FD. FS events D became events FSSD. NE helper became any help RD. Comm center root helper became comms center root helper. XPC role account D became role account D. The more we look at phones, Danica reported, the more we gather indicators. We kind of have to build a database of indicators. The increase in that database was crucial. By feeding this growing list of malicious process names into its brain, the Security Lab forensic tool was learning how to win, as one of our partners later opined, the world's most complicated game of spot the difference. Claudio and Danica were clearly gaining confidence in their evolving forensic tool late in April, and with good reason. They had just found traces of a Pegasus attack on Indian journalist MK Venu's iPhone, which seemed to be clean when they first analyzed it back in March. But it turned out that at least one Pegasus-generated process name that Claudio and Danica had discovered in Lineg Bredu's iPhone, OTPGREFD, was also sitting in the backup of MK's iPhone, stored on a drive at the security lab. Once you feel like you unlock something new you didn't know before, you'd go back and look at previous evidence, Claudio told us. Perhaps you find some things that you have missed before, or interpreted differently. Patterns and similarities that connected Pegasus end users were beginning to emerge. Multiple malicious NSO-produced spyware processes, Claudio and Danica had discovered, were operating on multiple infected iPhones, whether the NSO client was in India, Morocco, Mexico, Hungary, or any of the countries in our list. The recent forensics had also revealed some signature differences among NSO customers, making it possible to track and confirm exactly where specific digital attacks had originated. Each NSO licensee, it appeared from evidence in the cell phones, was using its own particular set of fabricated iCloud accounts to assist in launching attacks. Claudio and Danica had found multiple instances of iPhones being surreptitiously contacted at a key early stage of the Pegasus exploit by NSO-generated iCloud accounts with specific email addresses. Records of these iCloud or iMessage contacts, all of them using fake names, were then logged in a file deep in the phone. The victims of NSO's Moroccan clients might have been contacted by fakes such as burgers.079@gmail.com or naomiwerf772@gmail.com or bogardlisa803@gmail.com or linakeller@gmail.com. The victims of Indian clients by lee.85.holland@gmail.com or beckerfred@gmail.com or taylorjade0303@gmail.com. MK Venu's phone, and two others from India, had been contacted by herbrood2@gmail.com. Hungarian targets Szabolcs Panyi and András Szabo had both been secretly contacted by the make-believe Jessica Davies, 1345@outlook.com, and her make-believe sister, Emma Davies, 8266@gmail.com. The deep and widening forensic analysis was also affording Claudio and Danica fresh insight into the capabilities of the engineers and coders who were designing and building the Pegasus system. The genius of the technical team at NSO headquarters north of Tel Aviv was not apparent in the malware Pegasus licensees were using to spy on an iPhone and its owner. Kind of shitty, Claudio calls it, when pressed. The really sophisticated part of Pegasus isn't actually the Pegasus malware itself, Danica says. But the exploit, the actual way of injecting the spyware on the phone, is quite complicated, and it is something that changes all the time. The sophisticated weaponry that NSO's Pegasus system was deploying to inject its quite ordinary spyware was engineered to exploit vulnerabilities in, say, the Apple software and apps running on an iPhone. The security lab had already detected exploits engineered to attack through iMessage and Apple Photos. These weapons are known in the cybersecurity field as zero-day exploits, because that's exactly how much time a tech company like Apple or Google or Microsoft has known about the issue, and that's exactly how much time they have to fix the problem before an attack. 0 days. None. It's already too late. If an exploit can evade enough security protections and technical mitigations, it can eventually jailbreak the device and write whatever malicious code it desires into the iPhone. But as Claudio and Danica explained to us, a single exploit is rarely enough to break down modern cyber defenses and get access to the device. Researchers often need a chain of 3 or more exploits to do the trick, which means these sorts of weapons require a lot of man hours and money to develop. And they all start with a really skilled hacker or cyber researcher discovering a weakness in Apple's software and making sure it's kept a secret until they can sell it to the highest bidder. Claudio and Danica understood enough about the 0 days market to know that a single reliable exploit chain might go for $1 million or more. They had also seen and heard enough to believe that NSO was likely expending considerable cash on in-house research to develop its own proprietary zero-day weapons. The scale of NSO's business operations, with paying customers in dozens of countries, almost demanded it. It's completely worth it for NSO if they have to spend $5 million a year on an exploit room for iPhone, Claudio told us. If they can sell Pegasus to 50 different customers and they all pay millions. Claudio was convinced by what he was seeing that the researchers, coders, and engineers at NSO were engaged in a constant game of hide-and-seek with one of the most, reputedly, security-conscious tech companies on the planet, Apple. Apple patches when they know about it, Claudio says, but Apple can only fight what they know is out there. If they don't know about it, they can't patch. Apple's model is to fix what they can fix, but then create as much friction as possible. Remember, when you say, I want one iMessage exploit, it's never one exploit, he explained. When an iPhone gets compromised with an iMessage exploit, they are using maybe 3, 4, 5 different exploits packaged in one. There's so many things that NSO technicians have to compromise with an iPhone that make it a lot more complicated. They need to compromise a number of different security measures that Apple put into place purposely to add layers of complications before you can successfully get complete ownership of the device. The difficulty with compromising an iPhone is that you have to have a functioning exploit for all of these different security layers and all of it be reliable and working at once. They have to subvert all these other components of the operating system. One of them might get patched in the night, and they need to find something else to replace that one. So it's just not that straightforward. It's a pretty complex process. Laurent and I still had some serious concerns. Omar Radi and Khadija Ismailova right at the top. But the Pegasus project had moved well down the tracks on both the forensic analysis and the journalism in the month of April. We had identified important new partners, confirmed a number of infections, settled on key storylines. We were already beginning to plan a meeting for a much wider circle of partners to help us pursue those stories. On top of that, I felt like we were also beginning to get a handle on just what drove the rise and growth of NSO, as well as the spectacular overreach that followed. The world's most famous and infamous cyber surveillance company, from its founders down to its overworked researchers, had clearly come to understand the power and possibilities of vulnerability. You could say they built their entire business model on vulnerability. They did it in a country that had learned how to live with fear and how to conquer it.